Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn and Alice Bryant. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, the newest professional hockey team in the United States is leading the series for the championship of North American hockey. The Vegas Golden Knights of Las Vegas, Nevada, defeated the Washington Capitals of D.C. Monday night in Game 1. The score was 6-4. The Stanley Cup Finals is a best-of-seven games series. The Knights began its first season last October. At the time, Las Vegas was recovering from the worst mass shooting in the U.S. On October 1st, an attacker on a high floor of a Las Vegas hotel used a military-style assault rifle to shoot at a concert crowd below. The gunman killed 58 people and wounded more than 700. He then killed himself. Bill Bradley is with the sports department of the Las Vegas Review-Journal. He said the Golden Knights worked to help the city recover. He said team members went to blood banks, went to food banks, went to meet with first responders. People felt like they cared. The Knights are the first expansion team in the National Hockey League since 2000. They have broken several records in their first season. The team won 8 of their first 9 games. Then came some losses and injuries. But Bradley said the team had made fans with 600, 700, 800 people showing up for practices every day. One such fan is John LeBon. He said supporters started to think that the team could win a first season championship. He added, "As the season went on, they proved it could happen. And look where we are, Stanley Cup Finals." LeBon's son, Brandon, was also at the practice. He said the city's spirits lifted as the team continued to win. He said, "To have the team come at that time to lift the spirits of everybody, it was truly indescribable." Fan Anthony Valdovinos agrees, calling the city energized. He added, "People are happy, shaking hands, saying, 'Oh my God, you're a Knights fan? I'm a Knights fan.' It's good for the city." Camille Gable moved to Las Vegas from Michigan. She said Las Vegas is a city of transplants. She added, "Very few people are from here. Everybody moves here. So the Knights have really given the community something to band around. The Golden Knights are good, but can they win the Stanley Cup?" "Definitely," said fan Kevin Lewis as he and his family watched the team practice. "We've got the momentum. We're going to win it." Fans say whatever happens now, the Vegas Golden Knights are already champions to the Desert City.
A different kind of school in Pakistan is giving poor children, and sometimes their mothers too, a new chance to get an education. The program is called Street to School. Organizers launched it in the Pakistani city of Karachi in 2014. The idea was to create a school for children who played on the streets every day while their parents worked. Some parents chose not to send their children to school, while others did not have enough money to do so. The founder of Street to School is Mohammed Hassan. He says children who spend all day on the streets are at risk for a number of reasons. They are in danger of catching dangerous diseases and can also be caught up in crime and drug use. Others are forced to work. Street to School is a way to keep these children off the streets while providing them with a basic education and useful life skills. Hassan says the preschool education program centers on reading, writing, and mathematics. Students are also taught English as well as the local language, Urdu. In addition, Street to School includes sports activities and provides students with information on how to stay healthy and take care of themselves. Hassan says Street to School has been successful in getting children off the streets and on a new path toward an education in traditional schools. But running the school also taught him about another great need in the community.
We started this project for kids, but we found out very quickly that kids would bring their homework diaries without parents' signatures. That meant kids were not getting the needed help at home to do their homework. So we decided to create a special course for these parents so that they can have basic literacy to help their kids.
Uzma is a wife and mother who decided for herself she wanted to join Street to School.
I talked to my husband. He gave me his permission, which is a huge deal. So many women don't get this opportunity. This is why I am here today. I come here and I study with God's blessing. I have learned enough now that I don't feel dependent on anyone.
Tahira Bibi is a grandmother who has always worked as a clothes maker and never got the chance to attend school. She cannot read or write. She says watching her grandchildren moved her to act.
When I saw both my grandson and granddaughter studying, I also developed an interest in learning. I believe that knowledge has no age. People age, but knowledge never does. It has no limitation.
The Street to School program now teaches 15 adult women, and Hassan expects this number to keep growing. Karachi has other educational programs for street children. One of them is called the Street School. Two teenagers, Hassan and Shireen Zafar, started the program. It aims to bring education to the streets for groups of needy children around the city. The founders told Pakistan's Dunya News Television they decided to launch the school after a girl came up to them and asked an unusual question. Instead of asking for money, the girl asked, "Will you teach me?" The program started out with just two students, but grew to more than 200. The Zafars told Dunya News one of their main goals is to prevent people from abusing children as laborers. The street school also has begun to teach some adults, most of whom are parents of children involved in the program. I'm Brian Lynn.
It is 10:30 on a warm May night in Washington, D.C. Emily Skeels and a few friends are outside talking and laughing. One friend plays music from a wireless device. Skeels and friends have just finished a bicycle ride around the city on an event called D.C. Bike Party. Each month, hundreds of cyclists take to the city's streets for this highly imaginative group ride. They meet at DuPont Circle and roll onto the road in colorful clothing as the sun sets. Event volunteers lead the adventure. Skeels, who has lived in D.C. for many years, tells VOA what she likes about Bike Party.
I love bikes, and I love biking on streets without traffic. And all my friends go, and the weather's really nice right now.
Technically, there is traffic, but the huge group finds safety in numbers. And that's not all they find. The name Bike Party is just right, since this is more of a celebration on wheels than a usual cycling event. For one, it happens at night. And there's music, lots of it. For example, longtime event volunteer Danny Lesh brings along his sound bike, a bicycle with an oversized speaker system attached. Lesh built the system in 2012. He says he had a good feeling that great music could build a following for a community bike ride in D.C. He was right. Each month, he makes music playlists that fit with the event themes. Tonight, Lesh played funk music for the event's Photon Funk Ride in honor of the city's yearly funk parade. And then there are the costumes. Many riders dress in creative, brightly colored clothing to go with the themes. In October, for example, they dress up for Halloween. Washington, D.C. native Will Bien Duggan seriously regrets missing one Halloween ride a few years ago. It was a rainy, cold night, but Bike Party still went on. The event led cyclists to a party with live music at the Congressional Cemetery.
I saw the video of like everyone coming into it, and it was just something otherworldly. And I realized I like only Enchanted. In D.C. and only with Bike Party could you ever have that kind of experience, you know?
Along with exciting themes, music, and clothing, the party ride also brings out some very inventive bicycles. Event founder Leah Sarametis, a California native, says the creativity of the riders is always wonderful. Over the years, she has seen all kinds of bikes on Bike Party, including a penny farthing and a one-wheeled vehicle called a unicycle. In addition, every month, she says, a group of people on rollerblades take part and bring their own disco ball. About halfway through every bike party, riders stop at a park. They set down their bicycles and talk, laugh, make new friends, eat, drink, listen to music, and of course, they dance. I'm Alice Bryant.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Larry West and Morris Joyce continue the story of President Woodrow Wilson and American involvement in World War I.
'18 was the final year of the most terrible war the world had ever known. But World War I did not end quickly or easily. The German army made a final effort to defeat the Allies. The United States had entered the conflict, and Germany wanted a victory before large numbers of American troops could get to Europe. Germany's effort became easier after it signed a peace treaty with the new Bolshevik government in Russia. The treaty made it possible for Germany to use all its forces against the Allies on its western border. In the end, however, Germany's plan failed. Allied troops pushed back the German attack in a series of bloody battles. The addition of American soldiers greatly increased Allied strength.
The leader of American forces in Europe was General John J. Pershing. General Pershing used a weapon new to the world of war, air power. Airplanes were used first, simply as eyes in the sky. They discovered enemy positions so ground artillery could fire at them. Then they were used as fighter planes. They carried guns to shoot down other planes. Finally, planes were built big enough to carry bombs. General Pershing also used another new weapon of war, tanks. He put these inventions together for his battle plan against Germany.
Pershing's target was the Argonne Forest. It was a tree-covered area Germany had held since 1914. The forest was protected by barbed wire and by defensive positions built of steel and concrete. It was the strongest part of the German line. It also was the most important part. If Argonne fell, Germany's final lines of defense would fall. The fighting in the Argonne Forest was fierce. Thousands of men died. Sometimes troops got lost because the forest was so thick with trees. But day by day, the Allies pushed the Germans back.
Germany's leaders were losing hope. In September 1918, they met with German ruler Kaiser Wilhelm. The army chief reported that the war was lost. Germany had no choice, he said. It must give back all the territory it had seized and try to negotiate a peace agreement. Other officials told the Kaiser that the situation at home was bad, too. People were starving. Revolutionaries were plotting to overthrow the government. Kaiser Wilhelm agreed it might be best to seek peace now, before Germany was destroyed completely. He asked his foreign secretary to send a secret message to American President Woodrow Wilson. The message would propose immediate negotiations to end the war.
President Wilson received it. He did not tell the other Allied leaders. Instead, he returned a message to Germany. Wilson asked if Germany was willing to accept the peace proposals he had offered many months earlier. Germany's chancellor answered that his government did accept the proposals. However, the events of war ended the secret exchange of messages between Germany and the United States. German submarines had increased attacks on Allied shipping. 2 passenger ships were sunk. 820 persons were killed. Many were women and children. President Wilson was shocked. He told Germany there could be no peace negotiations with such an inhuman enemy.
In late October 1918, Wilson sent a final message to Germany. He wanted a settlement that would make it impossible for Germany to fight again. Germany, Wilson said, must promise to withdraw its forces from all Allied territory. It also must close its weapons factories. Wilson added that the Allies would negotiate only with a government that truly represented the people of Germany, not with military rulers. The new German chancellor was Maximilian, Prince of Baden. Prince Max received President Wilson's message. He succeeded in getting Kaiser Wilhelm to dismiss the man responsible for German military policy. But he failed to get the Kaiser himself to give up power.
Not all Allied leaders supported President Wilson's plan to end World War I. They could not agree on some parts of it. Britain, for example, opposed the part about freedom of the seas. Britain said it would prevent the kind of naval blockade which had been so effective against Germany. France and Italy opposed the part about creating a new international organization. Wilson had called it a League of Nations. To solve these differences, Wilson sent his closest advisor to Europe to meet with Allied leaders. The discussions were long and sometimes bitter. Many of the Allies thought Wilson was being too kind to the defeated enemy. But in the end, they all agreed to accept the plan as a starting point for peace talks.
By this time, in early November, the situation in Germany was growing worse. Communists and socialists were calling for a rebellion. The Navy was ordered to go to sea. Sailors refused and killed some officers. Reports told of rebellion in parts of the German army, too. The nation's leaders had no choice. They would negotiate a peace treaty. On the morning of November 8th, a German delegation went to Allied military headquarters to discuss terms.
The Germans were met by the Supreme Allied Commander, Marshal Ferdinand Foch of France. Foch greeted them coldly, and he did not offer peace terms until they officially asked for a ceasefire. Germany, not the Allies, had to put down its weapons first. The Germans were shocked when they heard the terms. The list was severe. Among other things, Germany must withdraw its forces from all occupied territories. It must give up Alsace-Lorraine, a part of France it had held for almost 50 years. It must give up most of its weapons, including airplanes, submarines, and battleships. And it must turn over large numbers of trucks, railroad engines, and other supplies.
The German delegation said it could not sign such an agreement. Germany, it said, was not surrendering. It was only asking for a ceasefire. The delegation said it could not accept the peace terms without communicating with the government in Berlin. But the German government was falling apart. Kaiser Wilhelm had finally resigned and left the country. A new cabinet had been formed, and a new prime minister had declared a German republic. Yet the situation remained unsettled. Because of this, the German delegation negotiating with the Allies had to decide for itself. After much argument, the men agreed to the Allied terms. They signed the peace treaty. A ceasefire began a few hours later.
News that the shooting had stopped set off wild celebrations throughout the world. People danced in the streets. They cheered the end of the worst war in history. There were celebrations along the battle lines, too. But these were quiet. Soldiers from both sides climbed out of long trenches dug in the ground. They met the men who, a short while earlier, had been their deadly enemy. The bloody European conflict was over. The dispute, however, was not. Another fierce battle was ready to begin. This time, the battle would be among diplomats. The fight over the peace treaty, officially ending World War I, was about to begin.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.